tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment. AfterBuzz TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
Sounds of that can only mean one thing. It's Throwback Thursday. We're going back to 1960s with the Prisoner After Show here on AfterBuzz TV. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We have Steph Z returning to the panel, as always.
Hey, guys. What's up?
We have Meredith Placco.
Howdy.
And we are very honored to welcome a special guest on today's show for Dance of the Dead. We have Curtis Armstrong, Booger from Revenge of the Nerds on Supernatural. But, if I may, you've seen the original series when it first aired.
Yeah, when it first aired in the U.S., I did. Yeah,
On
CBS in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
So I had just come back from Europe, and I was living in Detroit, and this came on during the summer and changed me.
In what ways?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I was a great science fiction fan, a great horror fan, a great fan of English television, which I saw when I was overseas, Avengers and Saint and so on. And this was just, everything about this show, The Prisoner, was like opening your head. There, even at my age at the time, I was probably 14 or something, but even then I knew I was going into something which had layers and layers and layers and wheels within wheels. And I was just utterly taken by it. And the fact that they had something as weird as Rover, which wasn't a monster, but it wasn't anything else. I mean, you couldn't fathom these kinds of things. So for me, it was a game-changing television experience.
And you know, we will get into today's episode, but you also had a chance to revisit multiple times, but with your daughter as well.
Yeah, I mean, so as of, you know, some few years ago, my daughter is 19 now. She was probably 14 or, you know, 13 at the time, and
that's the right age to get people.
You
started.
Yeah, probably the same age that I was when I saw it, and I said, well, you've got to see The Prisoner. She was an Avengers fan,
mm-hmm.
and I said, well, if you like the Avengers, you have to see this. So we wound up watching the entire series together, which was so much fun. So and now I'm here, and I was just so excited when I found out that you guys were doing this because it's a show that always warrants revisiting, in my view. And I've, you know, over the years since it's been on DVD, I go back to it periodically. I just think it's fantastic.
Absolutely.
So imaginative. So, it's amazing.
And so, let's start with Steph C, as always. Let's get general impressions. And Steph C, who's new to the series.
I am. Mm-hmm. I love it. This was actually a very entertaining episode for me. I couldn't, you know, the cat came back again, which, you know, last time I was like, there's kind of something about the cat. And you guys were like, no, it just kind of walked on set. So I didn't, and Meredith, before we went on air, mm-hmm. admitted that she was just screwing with me on purpose, which I can take it. So that's fun.
It's just because I don't want to give anything away.
No, so I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, sometimes mm-hmm. I can tell by like you guys, the way you look at me, you're like, oh, she figured that one out. Oh, she has no idea about this one.
I'm getting better with my acting.
I know, you are. You're totally getting
better. I'm
learning
to lie.
Yeah. But a great episode. It was way better than the last episode we watched that I felt was a little bit, snooze fest is dramatic, but it didn't do as much, it didn't provoke as much thought and curiosity as this episode did for me.
And she's referring to Many Happy Returns.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah, the art house film, 26 minute silent.
Yeah. Okay. Which it had a lot of information in not speaking, but I was just used to a certain pace, I guess, of the episode. And for me, I was like, what's happening? Did I miss something? What's happening?
Now, is Many Happy I don't remember the original seven. Is Many Happy Returns in the original seven?
I don't believe so.
Mm-mm.
I don't think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. And Meredith, for you?
So I love Dance of the Dead. I mean, obvious reasons, the whole costume, carnival, ball.
But and you're dressed up
I am.
Today.
I actually, yeah, it gave me an excuse to wear my awesome We Love Fine Portal jumpsuit. So we have the orange for the prisoner. The fact if you've ever played Portal, you're pretty much a prisoner in it. So I wanted to go in theme. But that aside, it is one of the more interesting episodes, especially with how they handle women. You know, overall, we do know McGoohan has a strict no relationship with women, but I feel like this is an episode that really tested those limits, but also the way that women throughout the episode were shown and how they interacted and acted from your number two to your overseer to the other characters, especially in the 60s, you see a really strong sense of women in control. And I really appreciated that because you think about the 60s as being a time for, you know, the women's rights movement where we're starting to get more say, more power.
Yeah.
And this episode was extremely thoughtful and also very forthright in women's place in society and where they should be. And I really appreciated that.
Very cool. And Curtis, what do you love about this? Because your daughter said, "Ooh, you're doing Dance of the Dead."
Yeah,
she got excited by that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I find it the episode to be kind of mysterious. I mean, even by the standards of this show, I also was fascinated with the role of women in this show because there are just, you know, from number two all the way down to, I think her name is Patsy Smart, mm-hmm. who you see is the night nurse when he's being tortured, who was in, Fahrenheit 451, as Julie Christie's, partner, mm-hmm. In that movie. And you know, so people with no lines, people with only a couple of lines for some reason in this episode, more than any other episode, tend to be women. And that was something that was interesting to me. And, of course, watching it now, you know, with an idea of actually studying this episode, it made me think about the whole discussion about where it comes in the chronology and thinking how, you know, if this were literature, if The Prisoner were literature, this would be, you know, the kind of literature that screams to be annotated and, you know, have a chronology yeah. of, you know, when he got there, mm-hmm. you know, when all of these things happened, in what order, and so on. We know there are all sorts of reasons why it's all confused and, you know, for various reasons. But, you know, you brought up the idea about his strict no relationship policy, which I've always found intriguing. I mean, what it is about that, about why he does it. But he does it to such an extent that he goes off to dance with Bo Peep and dances by walking with his arms crossed. I mean, it's just really repressed yeah. and yeah. strange.
And, you know, to kind of give, you know, I like to give mm-hmm. overview of the full kind of episode. So, ironically, this was one of the episodes that Patrick McGoohan hated,
yeah.
supposedly.
Yeah.
Wow.
And partly because of that reason. He you know, they were going to have him dance, and he was like, nope, not having it. And then through the editor, John Smith, he actually salvaged this and was able to piece it into something that, obviously, what we have on screen, and it does work. But it also, where we've been talking about George Markstein and the kind of rift between them, this is Don Chaffee. He kind of left after this episode and didn't want anything to do with The Prisoner. So there's a lot of history here. And it's the fourth one to actually be filmed. Even
this is the amazing thing, is that that rift occurred this early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you would really expect
later,
you know, them to have a little more yeah. time before they couldn't stand to be in the same room.
I think just because of the condensed shooting schedule, they were just around each other so much. So something that normally would have drawn out over months was done in really
exactly.
weeks.
Yeah. And also the woman who plays Norma Mason. Is it Norma Mason who plays his observer?
Yeah.
Who gave an interview saying that that at this point, this early on, McGoohan was in tatters. He, you know, lived in his dressing room. He was doing everything, including, you know, cutting and composing music, she says, which I've never heard before. I'm not sure that's true. But I think by any standards, he was at the end of his rope this early on, which was
very similar reports, and you know, he'd taken like an hour break, go into his room or wherever he was kind of located. Some say he did drink heavily and then he would come out, but then it was just all genius and that you couldn't tell. You know, he might like sway, but he was all business.
Like a high functioning alcoholic.
Yeah.
I don't know
whether or not those are just true reports. So I can't
rumors
say yeah rumors. Exactly.
Rumors.
A couple quick items of the overview. Some of the original ideas for number two's outfit was Father Time, because originally it was supposed to be a male, mm-hmm, ironically. But so we can debate, you know, we're all pointing to the females in this episode, but it was originally intended to be a male. So you had Father Time, Jack the Ripper, and Hitler. And some attribute,
which is so telling. If they were going to go with Hitler, that's
really a little over the top.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, that's more over the top than they tended to get.
Yeah, and they're not a literal. It's not a literal show. Everything is deep.
Right.
You know, with subversive. You know, like we don't want to beat you over the head. So I think I don't know how true Hitler would have been.
That would have been too much.
Yeah.
There are so many things about that I know it's true. And I know that it was intended not just to be a man. It was intended to be Trevor Howard, mm-hmm, who was one of the great English actors of his generation, a fabulous actor. And I can imagine why he wanted to get him on there. Mm-hmm. But there are elements to it being a woman which make it – just the scene where they meet on the beach. And it's the first time you see her in her Peter Pan outfit. And and he says, you know – Peter Pan, with your shadow, and it's just, I mean, it's just so perfect, and she is so perfect, and also very highly regarded English actor of her generation, the same generation.
Yeah, and we're discussing Mary Morris, who was number two.
Right. Yeah, and so we have a picture, here's a picture of her as Peter Pan in 1946.
Oh my God, look at that.
This is actually, she was Peter Pan she played Peter Pan in 1946, and she was the reason that they decided to put her in the Peter Pan costume for this episode.
And you kind of, Meredith, you grew up, this was first foray into Peter
Pan.
So
I was raised by wild Brits. I may have mentioned this on the show before, but my godparents did a lot of my raising, so this is why I was influenced and introduced to shows like The Prisoner and Danger Man. And this was actually the first, outside of the Disney cartoon, this is the first live-action Peter Pan I had ever seen.
Wow.
And so it was, you know, and obviously it's been 20 plus years since I have seen it, but I just, when I saw Mary on screen, I was like, no, that's, oh my God, it's her. I forgot she was in this. I'd gotten so excited. But yeah, she's just a phenomenal actor, and what she brings to this character is what I kind of see as the actual Peter Pan, a little bit sinister and not trusting of his motives. If you ever watch Once Upon a Time, they do a great job of characterizing Peter Pan of how I see him. But anyways, and just to see her have a nod to that made me really happy. It was just a nice, like the way that the show does give nods to some of the actors that they feature is really nice.
Yeah. Mm. And it's also interesting because you think about it, if it had been Trevor Howard or another man, that it would be Jack the Ripper, which is, it's not as effective. I mean, no one even knows what Jack the Ripper dressed like.
Yeah.
You know, you see Peter Pan, it's instant.
Well, and you think about Peter Pan, you know, he essentially, if you want to look at it in a very literal sense, he steals children from their home and keeps them locked up in a never land,
yes,
which in many ways, Neverland is a great parallel.
That's a really good point. And it's another one, you're just phrasing exactly what I couldn't phrase, which is why the whole idea of it having been meant for Trevor Howard doesn't feel right to me, mm-hmm, is the way that this pans out. That sums it up perfectly.
That's a great way to, absolutely.
Go, Merritt.
I have thoughts sometimes, guys.
I know. I like them.
But yeah, because I spent a lot of time thinking about this episode. Unlike every episode, there's different, you know, versions that we see how much literal meaning, but this one is just deep. It's like 18 layers deep. It's as we would say.
What I like about her, in particular, is that she has the right balance of femininity and masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where she's stern with all the men that she has to control in her life, but with him, she's very gentle and soft and everything like that.
I got such a different takeaway from this
episode.
Yeah, I don't know if right now is the time to interject it, but I...
Go ahead.
I, after watching this episode, felt that he was a prisoner to himself. That's what I took away from it. And the reasons why he doesn't have relationships and the reasons why he doesn't do these things is because the relationship that he's there dealing with is the relationship with himself.
I think that's actually a point, like a spot-on observation.
Okay, because, yeah. Well, I was like, wait, yeah. Like, because I was feeling like, and for me it was like, oh, number two's mm-hmm. a woman, so is that the motherly thing coming in and what he was taught? And I feel like, is he there because what he's done in his past and maybe in his career, he can't live with himself? Like, I felt it was such more of an internal thing happening that it was really that the village in this episode in particular was just his world, that these things were taken care of, but yet that internal, that he's a, like, yeah, that he's just a prisoner of himself.
Well, and this was a little bit more of a, like, yeah. This episode, he had a little bit more of a literal escape, like actually physically trying to leave the village. But as we've seen with other episodes, and spoiler alert, as we'll see, it doesn't always become about him escaping the village. It's him kind of escaping his own prison. And I think to make this observation so early on is really something I came to at the end of the series.
But look at the, look at the conclusion of him escaping, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah.
It led to his death.
Yeah.
In whatever form you want to call
maybe
it.
Maybe that's the only way to escape.
Could be, you know.
I'll be the dark one this week, Phil.
No, that's... Yeah, I know. Phil got dark last week. But yeah, that might be... Or to kill off that part of something. Not so, necessarily that he needs to die to escape, but something needs to be let go of.
So this is, you know, one of the things that I was going to talk about later was kind of self-identity. Who really... Is it you that assigns your identity, or is it assigned to you? Because the whole nature of this, everyone's given a costume by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, they give him his own costume because you could say that, you know, he interprets it as he stated as himself. But Meredith, you had a different interpretation, which I thought was great.
He says when the observer, or no, the maid mentions to him, you know, what is it? And he's like, oh, my own suit, special made for the occasion. It's not just him being assigned as an identity. To me, it reminded me of when you have a body, you're preparing them for a funeral, you get them dressed in their best suit.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
So to me, that just was that extra level of, like, they're preparing him for death.
Wow. See, I mean, I've always been curious about why they put him in an outfit that makes him actually more resemble the character he had made famous by, you know, the John Drake character, especially since he seemed to go through so many hoops to persuade people that was not who it was. And that's actually, you know, that sort of connects with what you're talking about in the real world, is that McGoohan was dealing with whatever his own issues were as a person, he was also dealing with a character who everyone associated himself with that he didn't want to be associated with, and yet he creates a show where he's playing a character which you'd have to be an idiot not to think that everybody is going to assume that that's the same character, because he acts the same. Everything about him is the same.
They're similar. There's, like, they bring over the same characters from Danger Man. We see a lot of the same actors in the same
I mean, that's not unusual, because a lot of people were working on all of those
shows. But they were still playing very similar roles.
Right.
That's the thing. And I'm just like, at the end of viewing the prisoner, it seems like it's like this is my death of John Drake.
Yeah.
100%. I agree. And I still think it's one of the funny reasons is, I think ultimately, is they didn't want to pay royalties.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's what it literally came down to in
the end.
That's probably true. I mean, think about it. If he goes into Lou Grade's office and says, you know, Lou Grade says, I want to develop a show with you because you're so famous as John Drake, the perfect one-line pitch for this show, or, you know, under those circumstances, would be John Drake tries to retire. They won't let him. The next thing he knows, he's in a prison village, this Orwellian village, from which he continues to try to escape while they try to find out why he... I mean, it's so simple, and it's so great. It's such an... But then, you know, in the process of doing this, he realizes that, you know, somebody says, well, you know, by the way, your character, John Drake, was created by someone, and that person's going to have to get character royalties.
And the budget was already too high to begin.
Then it becomes, well, okay, he's not really John Drake, and they never referred to him by name, ever.
Yeah.
Peter Smith.
Peter Smith, yeah, we got
that's
that
one. That's as good as we get. So I want to ask you guys, you know, since we're kind of going in these various directions, but in terms of the women, which one, apart from, let's say, number two, because we all feel very strongly about her, who did you guys have an affinity towards? And I guess the follow-up question would be, why was the prisoner so taken with his observer, who, up until later, he didn't really know that she was his observer 100%?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he always suspected. I mean, he's... As we've said,
well, it depends on how long he's been there.
That's true.
And what he knows, which is a whole other element to it.
Yeah.
You want to tackle this one first, Steph?
I was
because we got the maid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we got the observer.
I mean, the observer was just not creepy, so to speak, but the way she just popped up and down. But I did like the maid number 54. And I liked how she was there. She was around with the cat. She was explaining there's no animals. Like, that mm-hmm. tied back the whole cat thing for me, so that kind of stood out a little bit. But there were lots of, like, they all kind of, for me, had their own importance. So I feel like it's hard.
There's a lot of articles written about sort of a jealousy factor of the women towards the number six. Did you guys get that? How do you interpret
how,
that?
How so?
I didn't feel that at all.
From what I've read, they're kind of all vying for his attention. And now, granted, that's the village trying to get him.
Yeah,
I don't think that's any different.
I mean, I think that that's sort of... that's a slightly misogynist reading, I think, of the...
I mean, because it's sort of their job.
Yeah.
They're all not trying to get him so that it's something good for themselves or for him. They're trying to get him for the greater good of they're supposed to be doing that for the village.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't really buy that.
I read something on the AV Club that talked about the jealousy, and I didn't see that.
I saw it.
Yeah.
Not at all.
I really feel that's a more modern view being forced upon.
Yeah. I agree. I think that was that. I think the truth is that I think that if there had been women more generally cast in this show throughout, it wouldn't be quite so obvious, and this wouldn't be referred to as the women's episode, as I know some fans refer to it as the women's episode, because it's just so startling to have that many women in speaking roles on this show. They just didn't have them. Right. If there were more,
and especially
for
his attention, because he's never... made a move on any of them.
Well, it is too interesting watching in present day for my first time, because I understand, you know, what was happening in history with women when this show took place. But for me watching today, it wasn't the hugest thing that stood out in the entire episode that there was these women in it, because you put anything else on television and that can happen.
As far as I'm concerned, I refer to this episode as the cat episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the cat cat actually, not only is the cat there as a presence, which is interesting, but the fact that it's the one character, and I'm open to be corrected, in the entire series that he actually appears to have a desire to know better.
Yeah.
Connection with.
You know, he wants a connection with the cat. And I don't think there's any character in the series that you see that, male or female.
I would think you're right.
Yeah. And then discovers, according to her anyway, of course, the cat was in the last episode, right?
Yeah.
So she, and yet, when, you know, when he's having that late scene with number two, she says, oh, she works for me.
Yeah. Well, see, that's
she's
funny.
She's mine, whatever she said.
My thing that stuck out with the cat is when the maid gave him the tea or the drink that she gave him, I, again, was like, oh, here we go. They're poisoning him again. And then there was the cat walking by, and I thought what he was going to do was give it to the cat so that he could prove and see what's happening to him.
Oh. Well, there was also that jealousy of her against the cat. Because remember, there's that. I forget.
She's like she was.
I
just
gave milk.
Yeah,
you know, and it's gone.
I think if any, there was jealousy against the animal. The cat symbolizes so much, though, and I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. This episode was filmed previous to the one where the cat. We first see the cat on screen.
Yeah,
right?
That was like episode. Many Happy Returns, I believe, is like episode 13.
13, yeah. So.
And this was filmed as the fourth episode.
Okay. Many Happy Returns was episode 13.
It
was
remember, because we talked about it was supposed to be the season finale.
And then that would have sucked.
Yeah. Check back on that discussion for everything there.
There's just a real quick point I want to make real quick about the actresses specifically in the women's roles. Something that did stand out to me is just how well they were written. So a lot of times, especially less so in the past couple of years, but in the last 20 years with media, we see women playing very tropey roles. Like a woman has to be like either a damsel, or if they make her a masculine character, like a main character, it's almost over the top masculine. Mm-hmm. I felt these roles, they could have been played by man or woman either way, but they were so well done and written, especially at the time. Like, that's just something I really appreciated, watching women in cinema.
I agree.
I agree, too. I think most of them, that's what I was suggesting earlier, was the idea that if you put these roles in, if they were more generally played by both sexes rather than that, you know, a lot of these characters, I mean, the Observer is a little different, because when he is led to one table by number two, and she is supposedly expecting him to go where she's leading him, and just like a cat, you know, you try to lead it somewhere and it goes, and he just moves to the Observer, who's sitting there apparently not involved in anything, and starts engaging her. I'm not sure that would happen with you know, a regular male actor.
Yeah. Because but she herself was so striking. I mean,
But I think, too, at that point in time, I gave him the benefit of the doubt that he knew, because it's happened in the past, so he was trying to play that to extract information from her.
Well, I mean, I think the reason he went to her is because he was being led
away
somewhere
But
else.
I also think that if it was a male in that role, yes, it might have played out slightly different, but he still would have tried to do it in some sort of way. Because we've seen that before. We've seen him kind of buddy-buddy up to people to try and be like, why are you here? What are we doing? What are we, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like I get that there's a difference, but I still think all of them. And I do appreciate the way he treated her
as almost an equal, too.
Yes.
And so here's what I, you know, in terms of the Observer, what I liked was that, you know, the idea of an Observer is obviously not to get involved. Mm-hmm. And she did anything but. In the various ways of, you know, even the kangaroo court and all those things, and to the point that
she's more of a spy than an observer. Like an observer, I feel like why wouldn't she, if they're calling her the Observer, why wouldn't she just be in
I think
the
she's a good enforcer
room?
Yeah, because she knows she understands the rules, but she has no understanding of why. Mm. You know, and that goes back to the general, but she's just spewing out this information of like rule number 47, what, you know, anything like that. Just, hey, you're not supposed to have a radio.
She's just so entrenched in the ways of the village that she just stopped questioning. You know, she's a perfect pawn in many ways.
You know, it's funny though. I'm in a way, I also felt like she was young.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like she was slightly inexperienced. There was something about when she finds, I mean, you know, the truth is she follows him in the same way that many observers follow him,
mm-hmm.
male, you know, before this and after this. But when she shows up on the bell tower, she shows up with number two, and she is strictly an extra in that scene.
Right.
You know, she's it's definitely number two doing all of the, you know, the taking
talking.
Of the...
Mm-hmm. When you say young, you mean green?
Yeah,
that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Is inexperienced.
Just, you know, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And then when you see her start to crack a little bit in the kangaroo court, for whatever reason, it doesn't necessarily have to be attraction because he's an attractive man. It's that she knows there's something wrong. And it makes me think about what her future was at the village, because I'm not sure that she comes off tremendously well.
No.
You know, in the same way that the number twos always disappear, I'm not sure that, you know, she had a long future here.
Yeah, well, she definitely starts to see the village for what it is.
Yeah.
And you see that moment. See that moment played
absolutely.
Out is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Come on, Steph. You have a thought? No, say it.
Say it. But it to me, again, I don't know why I can't get away from that. This is all just his world and his happenings. So even with all the number twos changing, it's different, whether it be different feelings of different projects of this or that, different experiences he's had in his lives and where he thought he should be told, you know, one person was telling. It's almost like the devil and the angel on his shoulder sometimes in certain situations. I mean, maybe this could have been, you know, some childlike thing in him that he had to deal with, or I don't know, like I so tie it somehow.
It's all in his mind. Yeah. It's all a bad dream.
No, not that it's all a bad dream, but it's all an internal conflict, and it's all aspects of his life, because it's like when you go somewhere, it's like they say, it's like if you're having a bad time living in Los Angeles, you can't just think that you're going to move to Florida and have a better time, because you're still you in your same situation.
I'll give you one better.
What I felt. It's like no matter where he goes, he's still left with him, and he wants back at the village because you can't escape yourself because that's you.
I'm going to give you this is a different interpretation of kind of what you're saying, but, you know, in life, life will hand us the lessons continually over and over until we're ready to learn them. Does that make sense?
That feeds into exactly what I'm saying. So, like, at the end of the day, he's probably just the number one. And number two is all the society and stuff.
I thought number one was a computer.
I thought that too at a point.
Let's talk about that, and we'll talk about.
But it's so crazy to me because it's. I don't know.
I can't wait to hear what you have to say when you get to Once Upon a Time. That's what I'm looking forward to.
But you should come back.
Yeah, you should come back for the last episode.
That'd be so much fun. But in this episode, when he's, we've had the general where the computer was, you know, the end all being, and now we kind of have this machine that it could be in communications with number one. It could possibly be number one because it doesn't die.
Yeah.
So it continues ticking
away. Right,
but even
with the end all be all machine, that's like, I don't know, like the man and the government and the end all be all. Like there's a higher power that figures stuff out. You have to play by the rules of this game, but you're, I don't know, he just, it's so present to me, and I could be so wrong, and I'm so okay with that, but it's so present to me that it's happening within, that he has a lot more power than we're giving him, or he's, you know what I mean? Like, he thinks he's just stuck by all these outside things, but if he was to deal with this inside stuff, maybe he would be more freed.
Wow. Fair enough. So let me ask you this, because in this world that, whatever, for lack of a better term, that he's created or he's in.
I love it.
Enjoying.
Yeah. She always thinks
I love it. Yeah. I mean, what's so wonderful about that is that it's so internal, and I mean, it's not anything that I ever thought in during the time that I've watched this show. Never would that occur to me.
And that's just how enduring the show is.
He is clearly the man is like a tightly wound watch at all times, and he's on the verge of just coming apart.
Yeah, you know? He's about to get unglued.
But there's but you know the fact that that's what it's about never occurred to me.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So, one of the things that this brings up is there's a hierarchy of importance, right? We'll talk about Dutton in a minute. But with him, you know, he's always the most important kind of being and things like that. And if you look at it from a self-referential standpoint, there isn't any experience that any of us has had that's been outside of our own, right, first and foremost. And so if you look at it in that literal sense, everything that you've ever done supports the fact that you are the center of your universe.
And you could but that's really deep, but even just break it down simpler to every single time you fly on an airplane, they're like, first put on your oxygen mask, then help others. It's like you have to take care of your own being in order to be good out here in the world.
So what does that mean then?
It means that this is all in his head. This is all, the prisoner is don't be a prisoner to yourself. I don't know. I'm going to get crucified.
And how is he not?
Comments.
Okay. So just to continue this. So in the prisoner, how does he escape himself?
Well, he's got to deal with what he's done. He's got to, like, clearly he's a spy. So has he killed people? Has he done this? Has he done that? So all these things that he can't deal with is what's keeping him in prison to go be a normal person.
Here's the thing, he didn't like relationships and women in that regard of like, you know.
But it's not about relationships and women. It's because he's focusing on the relationship with him.
Where I'm going with this is religion. Because he didn't want to infuse religion into it either.
Well, don't get me started on religion.
But here's the thing. You're saying that he could have murdered. He could have done all these things. So how does he get absolved of all his sins?
there's many ways for people to feel good about themselves and come to peace with what they've done that can play over any religion. I'll just put it that way.
I'm not sure I understand where religion is coming
into this
at all.
Yeah, I don't feel like religion plays at all.
I'm just posing questions to you,
okay.
Steph.
Keep them
you're
coming.
So riled up that I'm just throwing anything at you.
I really do. I feel like this, the whole kit and caboodle is that this is about oneself.
See, I think that when you bring up, like, for example, the relationship question, without knowing that much about who he was, but just from what I've been able to glean, is that he was at the very least aware that as a romantic figure, he would not work.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't work. Can you imagine him in a romantic, real romantic relationship on camera? It would just not work. There's too many walls up for that to work.
I also feel that it would have detracted from the story. I think one of the strongest points about the prisoner is that they don't have the romantic entanglements.
Exactly.
Because it just, you know, again, he does. He has built up so many walls as a character and
Magoon
himself. But I feel also it was a nice, like, pushback from the time where you had the suave spy always with a hot lady on
right.
his arm. And it's like, no, let's break away from that mold.
Well, it's
let's
like
show
never carrying
different.
A gun.
Exactly.
The same thing which he also brought mm-hmm. to the table, which was, you know, keeping yeah. that element out of it.
Let's,
so there we go.
Yeah. Let's do a show where we don't rely on these.
Until the end.
Yeah.
This is going to be a left fielder.
Sorry, I'm picking dust off you.
That's okay. Is it no relationship to no alcohol because he's rehabbing himself? Like, that's one of the huge things that you say about rehab. You're not allowed to get involved with a relationship.
Yeah. Think of
that's
the time.
That's true.
Yeah.
That,
there's, I don't know.
By the way, they had alcohol in tonight's episode, correct?
Yes, they were all drinking wine.
Yeah.
He didn't.
He took it.
I don't remember whether he drank out of it,
but he was holding a wine glass.
But I feel like the reason why we're not seeing the outside relationships, because we do see in some of those dream sequences back that there are women that maybe he could have been involved with.
Like especially in ABC.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking mm-hmm. about, ABC. So I feel like right now we're just focusing on him.
Well, but then also you have the, was her name Janet, the woman who he goes to his house when he chimes Big Ben. He goes, if I'm remembering this correctly,
he goes back to his
apartment and she lives there.
Oh, that was Many Happy Returns.
Many Happy Returns. Yeah. That it was Many Happy Returns where he goes back there and this is an attractive, sophisticated a woman who you think would fit him perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And it never becomes an issue.
It was almost, and since we talked about this last week, we know her being number two ultimately, but there was definitely like a mother connection for me in Many Happy Returns, which I know I didn't get to touch on last week, but I really felt there was a maternal connection there.
Yeah, kind of.
And with a lot of the women,
It broke him a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you got the gentle side of number six when he was talking to her before things started to go.
And we see this, again, with Mary Morris's number two. We see a very gentle, maternal level with her when how she's dealing with him. Like, we don't want to break him, you know, something. Just go back from earlier in the episode when you have the doctor trying to do the mind mm-hmm. control experiment on him. And she steps in. She's like, no, we can't break him. He's too useful to us. You definitely see, like, this overarching, especially with women in the series, that there is a little bit of a... They're a bit more softer, which I don't want to say because that just seems like such a generic thing
cliche.
Would see about. Well, yeah, cliche is very. But she definitely, you know, and you touched on this earlier, Phil, the number two is she treats six differently from the rest of the cast. And I feel like there is an overarching theme developing with women and number six he's looking for more of a mother figure than a relationship.
Interesting. What about, you know, getting aside from relationship, what about friendship, right? Because Dutton, here's an opportunity. When I say opportunity, I don't mean in a negative way, but, you know, he could have really connected with this person and things like that. Like, they used to be friends. And we haven't really seen him fully kind of interact with anyone, in that way before, and we didn't really get it with Dutton either, except to the extent that they just exchanged information.
I mean, they didn't strike me as being friends. They struck me as being, you know, co-workers or acquaintances, business acquaintances. They worked for the same company. I got no sense of intimacy or friendship from them at all.
Yeah, I think the closest he ever had to developing a friendship was, I'm blanking on the episode, but the one number two where they find him in the cave and he's drinking and he starts to kind of... Was it number two or was it one of his old work buddies? But do you remember? It was the third episode I think we watched.
Third episode was when we do Free For All.
It might have been, but that was the closest friendship connection. Is where he like ends up in the cave and they're drinking like actual alcohol, and you get to see like the one guy deteriorating. That's the closest.
Free For All was the third one we did.
Yeah, I could be blanking.
I think it's
on
Free For All because then that's kind of right before, you know, where he sees the rover.
So I feel like that's the closest. But even in the first episode where one of his friends jumps out the window, you know, we don't see we do see a little bit of a reaction, but I think it's just an overall him as a spy.
I think you would have seen the same reaction out of him if it had been a total stranger.
Yeah.
Yes. Because it's realizing that these are supposedly, at least, these people are our side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as far as we know. And the fact that we're driving people to jump out windows, you get a natural response out of that.
Yeah. But, and what's interesting with that, too, is there continues to be non-acceptance of what it is by the village. Right? I mean, for all intents and purposes, we know why number six resigned. You know, consciousness.
Yeah.
Conscience. With him, it was, you know, he didn't have any more information to give. And so it's like, okay, well, that's just not good enough for us. It's like, well, what do you want? Information. Well, okay, I don't have any more to give.
But, and we see that again with Dutton, where, you know, there's that, no matter how much I give, it's not enough. You know, like they'll never believe what they want. Like they they won't.
Saw your eyes light up when you said that because you took that sentence out of context, didn't you?
No, it's just so. It all plays for me.
All going back to
it's all for my internal theory. Which
I've given all I can. I can't give anymore. Yeah. You're thinking in relationship terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to himself that he just can't do this anymore, and that's why he resigned.
Yeah. Well, what about the whole, I mean, there is that whole question, though, of whether he's actually with his own company or whether he's now in a place that's run by the other side, whatever that is. You know, this may not be his people. It may be that when he goes back to his apartment in that opening sequence to leave, the people who come and gas him and take him away is the other side because they want the information.
Right, but don't we see in Chimes of Big Ben, is it, when he goes back to London, that he knows all those people.
He knows them, but we don't. They were his colleagues, and he's had other colleagues, but we don't know really what side anybody's on.
Yeah, in Arrival, right? That was the whole thing with his friend jumping out the window. Mm-hmm. It was it was the same person that turned on him, and he said, "I'll give you a good report."
Yeah. So you can never trust. In the world of spies,
as he says in this episode, when she reveals that the cat actually is hers,
mm-hmm.
never trust a woman, even the four-legged variety. And it's like
it is a great line.
Well, I mean,
It's interesting. It's all just. I still feel like all of that can play to it still being him and his own life being a prisoner. That he doesn't know which side he's on. That he doesn't know how he got there. He doesn't know who to trust. He doesn't know all these things because he's been misled time after time after time.
I think it's a really great takeaway. I mean, to be honest, I think, you know, it's one of those things that, as we've talked before, there's just so many levels to how this plays out on an individual and on a societal level.
Well, I think also that he is somebody, Patrick McGoohan, had a very strong sense of how to play the show so that when you read interviews with him during the course of the show and even years afterwards, if they could get anybody to get him to talk about it, is that he remained so elusive in his intent and how he felt that, you know, the show was intended to be, that, you know, to the extent that in 67, when he gave a press conference in which he delivered from a cage, and all of the journalists who were present were subjected to questions from him. He didn't answer any questions. He only asked them questions.
That's
I
awesome.
Mean, this is like John and Yoko stuff.
Yeah.
It's so conscious of media and manipulation and all of that kind of thing. And what it means is that you have a series of 19 shows or whatever it is. 17 shows, which people still don't understand. And it will never know what the reasons were behind anything because he did it too well.
Mm-hmm.
And he was willing to go to the grave with it.
I agree a lot in that sense that there are, you come across people in life, artists, whatnot, that have a message of some sort to give that can really be timeless and taken year after year. And everyone, the fact that all four of us could sit here and have completely different takeaways is amazing. And the fact that they could have created that back in this day, something that would be, I mean, how much has the world changed since 1967?
And yet how relevant is this to right now?
Exactly. So that's, and it is, I mean, you talk about John Rocco like that. He's another one of those people that could do that. Like innovators of their time in a different way.
Well, and I mean, there were close associations anyway.
Right.
I mean, you know, John and Yoko were getting together at this point and the Beatles were all fans of this show. And to the extent that they gave him,
rights.
We should get Paul McCartney on this show too. Paul,
you know,
come on.
But
he might actually come. We do get a song. I will say that.
So, but that was one of the things that I found interesting about it is the ability over years and years when it ceased to matter anymore, and he's still protecting his intent, his artistic vision. He's still protecting it and just not revealing anything.
And again, I'm not just trying to play this into my theory, but if you think of people like the Beatles and people in that time frame, for me, what they were trying to do most was empower oneself. So that would go back to don't be your own prisoner in my world. I'm a huge Beatles fan. I have lots of history with that sort of thing. And high five.
Yeah.
My dad lived in Abbey Road Studios for a while. It was pretty neat. Yeah. So we'll talk after. But knowing the history of the Beatles and a lot of that stuff that they really, it was kind of like an anti-government, but it wasn't, it was more power and love within rather than.
It was utopian.
Yeah. Yes.
But here's the thing. And
that's what I feel that if you, like, somehow we all today are a prisoner to something.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Something. Multiple things. So for me, that even drives home more bringing that stuff up that, you know, the Beatles and what, that would be more so your prisoner of yourself.
Here's the thing. Like, I wasn't there for the 60s, but from everything that I've heard, everything that I've read, there hasn't been a generation like the 60s generation, right? And so as much as it was about, as you're saying, kind of internal, it was for the betterment of, you know, various things and not just about me, which...
No, I don't mean internal. I mean
personal growth.
Right, and it's be free to be me, and we all can be free together. But if you're not free to be you, then you can't participate in this bigger thing that can happen. So you got to, you know what I mean? And not at all was it selfish. It was actually the complete opposite of that.
Yeah.
But knowing that you need to look within in order to feel that.
Well, this all comes together with something else, which was this 1967, 66, 67. This was the period where, and the Beatles were at the forefront of this, the introduction to Indian mysticism, Indian music and meditation. All of those things were happening in this year and this show was happening in this year and, you know, in the same way that an album like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band becomes something which is almost on another level from anything else at any time, this show was on another level from anything else at, you know, before or since. And the two of them had these connections. And even just looking at the clothing design on this show, as timeless as the show is, the only thing that dates it is the clothing, which is 1967, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's Carnaby Street stuff.
Right.
You know? And all of this stuff winds up being part of the culture at the time. And it's one of the things which, because I was young, but aware. Mm-hmm. Of all of that at the time. The drugs were not a part of my life at that point, but everything else was.
Yeah. And I would think too that some of these and I'm not trying to say people should go out and do drugs, but some of these drugs do enhance people to think beyond and go beyond the box or what the government or society puts on people, which I think enhanced the outcome of what some, like, these people were free thinkers and they thought beyond. And most people might be scared by some of these thoughts or might, you know, it would create fear for a lot. But for them, this was freeing.
But it is interesting that we see the way drug use is applied in this show, that every time it's used for, like, a manipulation torture technique. So it definitely has, like, an almost, you know, like the no drinking, an almost anti.
Right. I'm sure that that was part of his thing, too.
Interesting.
I mean, you know, there was a definite conservatism to his character, to his outlook. And I found it interesting and may be telling, and it may not be telling, that the Be Seeing You, the salute was supposedly the ancient Christians used to identify, you know, that you were one of them. And that may have to do with some of his more restricted, you know, worldview things. I don't know.
Speaking of, you know, you mentioned costumes. One of the things that I find interesting about this episode is we kind of mentioned it, but how your costume defines your identity, right? So if you went into William Morris, looking like
which is a talent agency for some of you people out there that don't know what that is.
I'm waiting to see where this is.
Let's go Wall Street. I'll say Wall Street because people will kind of understand.
Okay.
If I went into Wall Street in cargo shorts, I would be laughed at. Because that's not the proper costume for Wall Street.
Right.
Well, see, that all goes back to me.
But if I went fishing...
Well, for me, that actually is changing. I feel like that's a lot of perception because what we do is we perceive dressed nice and like a suit and tie with success because of stuff like that. But now you have more of the .com million/billionaires who go to work in flip-flops and shorts. So I feel like that perception is actually changing, and if Mark Zuckerberg went to go ring, I know people that have rung the Wall Street bell. They're not wearing suits and ties.
But here's the thing: then that perception is, he's just eccentric, and he's an eccentric genius.
I think you're going black or white on that.
I think there's a very big gray
that's happening.
Yeah, I think we're putting way too much modern thought on the whole costume thing. I think the costume thing is a great in terms of the prisoner. I mean, it's showing that everyone's identity is hidden. Like, and that's the time during the carnival, the masquerade part, nobody has their numbers.
That's true.
That's true.
It's very like
true.
The only time.
And in fact, you don't know the difference between the maid and one of the actual prisoners who's, you know, you can't tell the difference between the prisoner and the warder in those scenes.
And this was the only time that the prisoner was referred to as the prisoner.
Prisoner.
Yeah. Yes. You know, the other thing that stuck out for me, and it could be irrelevant, was that the number 2 button was on the different side in this episode.
I didn't notice that.
You noticed it? Yeah. So I was like, what is it?
What does that mean?
Yeah. Only time it's happened so far.
Interesting.
I don't know.
I don't have any idea.
That's you won't get really stabbed in the heart because it has to be pinned on your
head? I don't know. Hopefully someone in the comments can offer some.
I mean, she did have a scarf on, but I feel like there was a choice. I don't feel like it was
an accident.
An accident that they put the scarf down on that side and the button over here. I feel like that was a choice.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know how to interpret that, but there's something there.
I'm so glad you saw it, too.
I know.
Then you all would have been like, come on, Steph.
No. I'm actually shocked we don't have a picture of it.
Yeah.
Also, I just really want to appreciate that this was the best use of like, random costumes from England at the time. Because if you watch a couple other period pieces, you can kind of pick out where some of the stuff has come from.
Yeah.
One of my favorite, like, hobbies is, like, that was used in Elizabeth the Golden Age and also in The Other Blind Girl. So I have a couple websites I subscribe to, so now I want to go pinpoint
those. And all of these interior scenes were shot in London, where they would have had
access to the warhouses. Yeah.
Oh, your Burning Man costumes must be crazy.
I'm excited. That's actually why I'm excited about Burning Man, is to make costumes for it. Sorry.
By the way, for those of you who don't know, Meredith just started a cosplay show on Popcorn Talk Network. Yeah. So definitely check that out. First episode is up. It's about Cinderella, but then she's going to run the gamut.
I am. Next week will be Game of Thrones.
Excellent.
Yeah. Sweet. I want to dress up and come on.
Yes, everyone come hang out with me. But yeah, but I want to actually dress up as now I can feel like I could do a prisoner episode just because. Actually, the wardrobe in The Prisoner. We were talking a little bit about how pointed from the 60s it is. But one of the things I love, you haven't talked about in a while, but all the Disney references.
Oh, there was a lot of
She would like with the cape. She felt in Arrival.
Like Snow White.
Yeah, Snow White. You felt like a Sleeping Beauty reference.
Oh,
yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I feel like for this, I was just taken into party.
Yeah.
So, and so I saw a lot of them, but yeah, I definitely.
There were a lot of sad clowns. Yeah. So there was one right up there, too.
A lot of sad clowns. Yeah. Also, a strange thing, which I just want to point out, has nothing to do with costume, but an interesting thing that I saw, which I've seen elsewhere, I think. Whenever they have the masses of villagers, and outside, and in this case, it's when Aubrey Morris, who I just parenthetically wonder whether he was related to Mary Morris, who is reading the proclamation for the carnival. And then everybody bursts into applause and cheers and everything. And there is not one extra on that stage who is making a sound. It's all recorded sounds. I mean, and they dwell on these people as they're marching, you know, with all of their things. Nobody is cheering. Nobody is laughing. And it's almost so obvious that it's intended.
Yeah, I noticed that, too. I was like,
it's like they're broadcasting it over the village sound system in order to give the impression, like everything else, that these people are all excited about the event. And then you see them on the inside, and they're all
very dour face. Very
nobody is having a good time.
I don't want to go to that party.
Yeah, I mean, it was it was just so like, well, and I mean, by the end when he says he's like, you know, and it by order, you know, like this is we will do this. You will attend.
Yeah,
you will attend. You will be happy. And then everyone's like,
and by the way, to the same notion of free for all, right? It happens once a year, right? So it's supposed to be this big event once a year. But I get the notion that they have once a year thing every 3 days.
Whenever they need to.
And I feel like this has never happened before. Yeah.
You know, and it's also one of the arguments for this being very soon after his arrival. And there are discussions about that because when number two explains to him about the carnival, it's like she's explaining to him something he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And she has to explain it to him, and he doesn't say, I know. I'm not going.
And by the way,
which he would later.
Right. To that point, you know, one of the things that keeps getting brought up, it's a game. You have to play the game, you know? And so I really like that notion of, it's basically saying you just have to participate in the village, and if you don't, it's not going to be a fun experience.
To say the least.
Yeah.
There you go. A couple of things that I wanted to ask you guys, because I didn't fully get to look too much into it. These French names sometimes, I'm never going to... do you know how to pronounce that name?
Jean Cocteau.
So his
feels like so him.
Yeah,
that guy.
I'm terrible with names. If I didn't hear Steph Z 800 times a day say her name, I probably wouldn't know how to say your name.
Interesting.
But anyway, his story, Orphée, it's about a hero.
Orpheus.
Who's,
Orphée. And we're there not is discussing an the story. Diver.
Yeah.
What's that?
We're not discussing the diver, Jean Cocteau. I was confused. I thought when I saw his name, I was like, we're not discussing the marine biologist diver guy.
No, unless it ties in.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
Never mind. I'm going to go hang out in my weird Florida corner now.
Fair enough.
But yeah, no, Orphée, a hero lost amongst the dead.
Yes. Are you guys familiar? No.
No.
I'll show you. Well, I mean...
And I should have looked that up before I came in.
No, it just kind of seemed to me like when everyone was dancing, a lot of references have been made to, like, you know, everyone's just kind of dead inside. And you can argue that the prisoner is the only one alive at this moment in time, but is he really?
I don't know that movie. I don't.
So, Are you guys familiar with French history? Because in the French Revolutionary, the tribunals, there were three of them, just like
French Revolution. Yeah,
in the episode of, you know, there was three judges in this episode, and it
really did kind of mirror the trials, you know, after the revolution happened, when you have Marie Antoinette imprisoned, and how they were just looking to basically punish and hang any noble or royal just so they could. I mean, it was. It's a kangaroo court. You made a great observation with that in the notes. But, you know, this was a direct. The kangaroo court we see in The Prisoner is a direct influence by the French tribunal.
But this is also an area which I find perplexing about this episode, which is he starts to leave after being condemned to death.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really going to kill him, so it's kind of a hollow judgment anyway. He starts to leave and then instinctively knows that they're about to come after him and starts running. Which is a great creepy moment, you know,
right.
And they
yeah.
start screaming again without moving their mouths. They're screaming and chasing him, you know, around. What is going to happen once they capture him? I mean, the impression is that we're really clear before and after. They're not going to kill him. They're going to do everything that they can to keep him alive so they can get what they want from him.
I think the condemned to death is just to continue living. I mean, that to me, that's the ultimate death for
True,
him.
True, but what strikes it, what makes it feel a little bit more than that is the fact that he's then being chased by this mob, which goes back to the French Revolution, the terrorists in the French Revolution as well, is there's this sense that if these people get hold of him, they're going to just tear him apart.
I feel like, much like in previous episodes, the villagers are play acting.
Yes.
And I feel like this is, in fact, and I felt that this half of the episode was a play. I felt that it was kind of like everyone was an actor. He was the only like real life participant. And I felt that this was a show that they were never going to catch him, that they were just putting on the motions. And we see that with the sound effects.
But I mean, exactly.
Yeah, but I don't think at this point he realizes it. I think he truly believes that
they're going to tear him apart.
Yeah.
Well, that would make sense also with the idea that he's just arrived in the village and doesn't know what's going to happen. So that makes sense. Less sense is the computer.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Why? Yeah.
And I mean, it's a great image of him ripping all of the wires out and then having her standing there and laughing as the machine starts up again without wires. Great image and symbolic of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a weird thing to end the episode with.
This is not very deep at all, but it's almost like it's almost like when you need a piece of machinery to work, it doesn't work, and then when you try to destroy it, you can't.
Just turn it off and on again.
That's what makes it work.
Yeah,
yeah.
I feel like that was an afterthought.
It felt like they were stuck with an ending.
Yeah, to me,
because he comes after this chase. He comes into this Regency sitting room, you know, done up in sort of Regency style in that sitting room, and finds the... What does it mean, and why does he...
The only thing in my little theory that I had from this one was that it was his brain, and no matter what, it can't stop thinking. He can't escape his own...
Well, you know what? It fits with everything else you've said.
Yeah.
It fits with everything.
But it's so weird because it was this episode in particular that made me feel all that. So for me, it was like, okay, yeah, at the end, like this is the computer to us. And if you try and destroy it, you're still going to think it's still going.
You're going to go back to my deep, dark thoughts of last week.
Well, it's interesting, too, because the movie starts with them messing with his computer.
Yeah.
And then at the end, he rips out the computer. But, I mean,
I'm going to go with a really literal interpretation that we know that there was a lot of issues in filming this.
Yeah.
And I feel like...
I have a feeling that that's more where I would go.
And I like to
subvert
meaning
on everything. Now you're just screwing with me again?
I truly just believe they were like, here's an ending. Surprise.
We
got to close it.
It feels kind of stuck on.
If this had aired like right before or right after The General, I would have put more meaning into the computer, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the mini General.
It is. The Babby channel.
The mini-me.
Yeah. So there you go. Any other stuff that we've kind of touched upon a lot of stuff, but is there anything that you guys want to talk about a little bit more? Anything that we haven't discussed yet? Any left fielders, Stephsy?
No.
Meredith?
No, I got to cover my points.
All right. Curtis, I'll let this, you know, whether about this episode or anything in general for The Prisoner that you'd like to get out to fans.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I think I've expressed my feeling about it. It's, you know, to me, there were probably three television series in 30 years that I cared anything about, and this was one of them.
So, Avengers was number two.
Avengers was number two. Star Trek was number three.
Yes.
Twilight Zone also.
There we go.
So, you know, there's not a lot that, it just is endlessly fascinating. And when I found out I was officially doing this, I went and got the disc out and was watching this and just remembering it never gets old. It's just so timeless. It's just endlessly interesting and convoluted.
Do you think you'll go back and rewatch all of them now?
I the only thing that stops me right now is a lack of time from doing it. I'm trying to be good and watch other things because that's my job now, kind of. So I have to try and keep up with stuff. Otherwise, that's all I would do. I'd watch, you know, shows that I care about.
Let me ask this. We talked about this last week a little bit because it was a much lighter episode, but we talked about the AMC remake and we talked about the possibility of a movie. What's your stance on either?
You know what? I think the best intentions in the world when it comes to remakes, this is doomed. I don't care who you are. This is doomed. You will never, it is of its time in the way that we were talking, like Sergeant Pepper is of its time or Citizen Kane is of its time. This show is of that level of fixed in time. You can do it, sure. Somebody will come up with the money for that. What do we get out of it? You're never going to get anything more fascinating or frustrating or bewildering or exciting or intellectually stimulating as this show was at a time where there wasn't a lot of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you, but in the same sense, how many people would go see this and could apply it to present day that will never know what this show is now?
You know, they can read 1984 and get the same impression. You know, I mean, it's you either get it or you don't get it.
Yeah.
By remaking it, you know, I have an issue with remakes. I just
I kind of agree with you. I just feel like for me, it was when we talked about it last week. It was more so like I want as many people as they can to somehow be a part of this.
Yeah, I think we'd hit on a good formula.
Yeah.
If they were to do like a movie. Sense.
I think a movie would be different for me because it's a slightly different medium than a TV show.
But God, that AMC. It's dead to me. It doesn't exist.
It doesn't either.
I gave it a chance. Because I was fascinated that anybody would
really
try.
I gave it two episodes.
That was exactly when I fell out.
And I tried.
And you know, I think what we had talked about, and the only way for me, I think you just have to take the spirit of it as best you can and just kind of run with it to do as much of a literal take of like, oh, we got to have Rover, we got to have this. It's just that for me wouldn't work because that's trying too hard. But if you take the spirit, just like if you adapt a book into a movie, you just got to take what the spirit of the book is and interpret it.
You know, I think, you know, having heard you describe your takeaway from this, I think that you know, something along those lines would be the only way I could see this being remade by anybody is if you had a movie. I don't think you could do a TV show, but if you had a movie where, you know, it was that kind of internal prison and all of that kind of thing. But even that's been done.
You know,
that moment in Brazil at the end when you realize, you know, it's been done before, but that kind of thing, that extreme would be maybe a way of doing it that wouldn't just make you roll your eyes.
Get to writing. Your new
I'm
job
on
now.
On it.
Script writer.
You can get some time before you get to Coachella.
Do it in the car.
In the helicopter. Write it in the helicopter.
All right, guys. Well, that about does it for us. get to learn chess because next week we are doing Checkmate.
Love chess. Can we just have a live action chess board of all the AfterBuzz hosts outside?
We should, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll
love chess.
We would we should do a game where us three versus all fans.
Yeah.
You know, like just one giant chess game. That'll be fun.
I mean,
let's figure out how to make that happen. I also want to remind, April 17th is right around the corner. So if you want to visit Port Marion and for the Six of One Society, Darren Nesbitt is going to be there, who was number two in It's Your Funeral. We haven't discussed that one yet. We will, of course. But April 17th, go there. Visit.
We'll be there next year.
Yeah. Phil That's promised.
Right. Phil gave.
But I wanted to get through all the prisoner episodes before we
go.
Yeah.
You know, because we can't go to the village without knowing what the village
You'll
fully
come with
is.
Us, right, Curtis?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I was saying just last night to Elaine, I was saying, for years I've wanted to go there. And
next year.
There we go.
Maybe next year.
AB.
Wait, TV you just said, so we're going to actually find out exactly what the village is?
We'll find out if we find
we'll
out.
We'll find out what they say.
Okay, because you just said we can't bring you there without knowing what the village is.
Yeah, well, we have to get through all 17 episodes.
All right, fair enough. Just
today we're talking about
words.
Self-internalization. Next week we can talk about global
Next
warming.
Week,
I don't
know. Yeah, I could be like, he is so in who knows where.
So there you have it. Thank you guys for joining us. Shout out to Curtis Armstrong.
Thank you so much. I really
Twitter
enjoyed
is
it.
Curtis is Booger.
Curtis is Booger, yeah.
I love it.
Oh my God, I love it.
Amazing. Steph Z.
You guys can find me on Instagram, Twitter, IAMSTEFZ.
And Instagram, Twitter, at MPLACKO.
And Curtis, is there anything else you want to tell fans in terms of what to look out for of your project specifically?
Oh, no, not too much. My last Supernatural for the season is next week, next Wednesday night at 9. Next New Girl is probably a couple weeks after that.
Oh, cool.
But everything else is pretty much down for the summer.
Very cool. So. All right. Well, we hope to have you back, maybe for at least for the season finale.
That'd I would be, love to come back. Wonderful. Just let me know if I can work it out. I would love to come back.
Of course. All right. Thank you, fans. Let us know your comments. There, without you guys, you know, it's not
it would
going
be much
serious.
Quieter.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We'll see you next week with Checkmate.
Yes. Be seeing you.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
Yeah.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.